From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Barely had the blood dried from the hundreds of dead or injured victims of Monday morning's mass shooting in Las Vegas when some right-wing media outlets began publishing so-called news about the suspected shooter. Some of the reports claimed the alleged shooter, Stephen Paddock, was an anti-Donald Trump liberal. While that isn't terribly surprising, what was much more problematic was that Facebook and Google's automated algorithms elevated those stories, giving them prominence just in the hours after the tragedy. The ad-based structures of these online companies and how they end up promoting polarizing and often dishonest news has become the focus of politicians recently, especially after last November's election, when Facebook and other social media companies were thought to have played a significant role. My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan, director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. His book is called Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. Welcome to the program, Ramesh.
It's a pleasure to be back, Sonali.
So let's talk about what it was that these news stories, and I say the word news in huge quotes, put out. Particularly, there were two places. One is a site that I suppose is sort of like Breitbart called Gateway Pundit, and the other one is a forum called 4chan. And Gateway Pundit basically put out this news saying that they were that the person who killed these people was a Donald Trump supporter. Liberal. Have you seen that? What do you make of what they put out? And it apparently looks like they've taken it down since.
Right. So, of course, there are various forums and various spaces on the internet for conspiracy theories, for people to share their ideas based on how they'd like the world to be rather than the world as it actually is. And 4chan is one of the most well-known of those. 4chan is a forum that's frequented by conspiracy theorists of all stripes, but more recently, it's been one of those spaces where a number of the alt-right supporters online have gone and spread information. But what's particularly troubling is how information that has its genesis in this ecosystem is able to bubble up and actually become what is seen as most visible and therefore credible and politically influential on the platforms that completely dominate the United States and the world, specifically on Google and on Facebook.
It's not. It's not that we should be surprised that these theories are out there floating. I mean, you're going to have that every time. You know, anytime you have a thing like the internet, there's going to be views on every part of the spectrum. The question is, how do these major companies that we rely on, you know, Google and Facebook, that billions of people use, how did they end up picking up these what should be seen as radical fringe views and making them prominent?
Right, and let me speak to that. So basically, the currency that is optimized in terms of what is visible and what's not, both on Facebook and on Google, has everything to do with what people will spend more time looking at, what people will click on, and what people will spread. Those are the forms of data that we give up that are monetized for billions and billions of dollars by these companies. So if you basically build an algorithm that is monetized for corporate commercial, you know, viability and corporate commercial gain at the absence of truth, multiple viewpoints, fact-checking, perspectives that are sort of more open and outside of the kind of technological black boxes, if you build it solely based on your own commercial gain, and what you gain, you basically extract data into oil and wealth, which is essentially what happens in both Facebook and Google's case, then content that is more sensational, content that's more, you know, sort of clicked on and liked, content that has more of a hysteria or kind of a spectacle associated with it, is going to bubble up to the top. And we now see that repeatedly. So there's the absolute absence of any sort of corporate responsibility, any sort of journalistic gatekeeping. These are platforms that are basically selling themselves to the highest bidder. And in this case, it's not the bidder of someone giving them money, it's the bidder of grabbing people's attention.
So those sensationalist headlines, what we refer to as clickbait, basically measure dollars through clicks, and that very basis of the revenue structure of these companies ends up elevating these. So 4chan apparently put out this view, and it seems as though these outlets, these forums, they understand how it works. They take advantage of the system too. 4chan put out this view that the Vegas shooter was a Democrat who liked Rachel Maddow. He hated Donald Trump, and then Gateway Pundit picked it up. And Gateway Pundit, it should also be mentioned, is a media outlet. I suppose, you know, it's hard to use the term media outlet, but it we have to use that term because the Trump administration has credentialed it, has actually considered this a legitimate media outlet.
President Trump has a long history of retweeting and at times even posting content that comes out of the conspiracy theory world. This is part of the administration's assault on journalism and journalistic institutions. Yes, indeed, there was a fake story created that identified someone named Gary Danley, who I guess is related or potentially the husband of the actual shooter's girlfriend or partner or companion. And then this was linked to everything that the people who wrote this story on 4chan wanted to attack. So obviously you mentioned Rachel Maddow, even Antifa was somehow connected to all of this. The point is again, these sorts of stories can proliferate and populate themselves because all that Facebook and Google want is our attention. Because when we provide attention, we're actually providing data in ways that we as users have almost no awareness of and any power over. And so the problem here is that this can spiral very rapidly. And Google had actually made a decision recently to include in news content that wasn't traditionally journalistically vetted. So that's part of the problem that came up here in the Google case as well. But, you know, always throughout history, digital platforms have proliferated misinformation. But this is particularly troubling, not only because they're the most powerful and dominant media platforms in our country and in our world, but also because they present themselves as neutral arbiters of truth and information.
When they're neutral arbiters that rely on a very clearly flawed ad-based structure, revenue-based structure. Now, of course, we don't want to see fake news rise to the top, but neither do we want companies like Google and Facebook deciding for themselves who should be considered legitimate, what should be considered a legitimate news outlet or not. For example, my show, an independent show, may not pass such a test. Something considered legitimate. There are nonprofit media outlets or independent media outlets that are non-traditional, but that doesn't mean they, of course, are putting out fake news. So that means you need people who are reviewing content, right?
Yes, and 2 points about this. First of all, it's very interesting how many of us who've studied media or come out of the independent media world or really believe in grassroots and people's media have had this critique of establishment corporate journalistic media for many years, right? And that critique has been basically essentially taken, the rug has been pulled out from under us, and it's been absorbed by kind of right-wing disinformation and now a presidency that perpetuates those sorts of ways of looking at things. So we have to always have a vigilance about solely supporting, you know, centrist corporate media that at the end of the day doesn't challenge certain issues around markets and capitalism and neoliberalism in different forms. So we always have to have that vigilance. However, at the same time, it's extremely important for us to also remember that the hiring of more laborers, right, which is generally speaking what Facebook tends to do, and to some extent we'll see what Google's response is on this. Usually they hire more people, but those people tend to be invisible from all of us. They tend to generally be outsourced laborers. In many cases, the content moderators who've been hired by Facebook and various sort of embarrassments it's had in the past are in the Philippines. We don't know the terms of their employment. We don't know if they're getting benefits. They aren't, actually, most likely. We don't know how long their contracts are for. So this is also a perpetuation as a solution of various sorts of labor patterns that are deeply troubling about major tech big data corporations.
So what happened to the steps that, say, Facebook said it was going to take? I mentioned that it came under fire just in recent weeks about the role that Russian bought ads were thought to have played in the election last year. And in response, Mark Zuckerberg put out this 9-point, I think, plan about actions that he was going to take. And lo and behold, right now, in the aftermath of this mass shooting, it looks like some of those simply failed. Some of the actions that he said Facebook would take, either haven't been implemented yet or failed.
Yeah, so basically what we've seen happen now, the Russian revelations are really interesting because what we found out is that Russian ads were bought for not necessarily a lot of money in this kind of massive, you know, revenue digital world, but $100,000, $150,000 based on different estimates. And the ads were targeted to specific voters that promoted misinformation, again, as sponsored news stories, which parallels what we saw occurring in some sense with Cambridge Analytica, which Steve Bannon sits on the board of, which used psychologically targeted news stories to incentivize or disincentivize people to vote a particular way or not vote at all. So this all has to be fundamentally revisited right now, because clearly the sort of language and the kind of like, oh, we'll do better next time, or oh, this is a normal problem by delegating things to computers. Well, it's in Facebook and Google's best interest to delegate labor to computers so they don't have to pay that labor or support that labor. So we need a fundamental revisiting of these labor practices and these journalistic practices. So what Facebook and Google need to do right now is tell us what is it in qualitative ways. They don't have to give us their, you know, code, their software code. They need to tell us what is it that's driving visibility and non-visibility, and how can that be impacted in different ways. They need to make a journalistic social contract with us that is open to various media sources, but also vets those media sources according to a set of principles that they're transparent around. None of those things are actually happening, but all of them need to happen, because at some point, the spectacle of misinformation is going to get so large. I feel like we're almost there, where I hope people will say, hey, Facebook and Google, this is no good anymore. There's going to have to be enough pressure from the mainstream world, like the political world, the consumer world. If you continue with this, we're going to step away from you. We're going to divest from you.
And this, of course, is an issue that should be framed within the fact that Google and Facebook have made a lot of money on this ad revenue-based model, these algorithms, these automated algorithms that enable them to rake in the cash without having to hire as many people as they should. So they have profited handsomely off the current structure that they're in today. Ramesh, how should we put this into context, finally, in terms of the importance of this conversation? It might seem to be a trivial matter to discuss what pieces of news Facebook elevates or Google elevates after a tragedy. But these do play a bigger role than we think they do within our broader political landscape, right?
In 2016, people spend 51% of their time of their waking life online. So
wow.
If our experiences online are so central in shaping our lives, and there's plenty of research that shows that the results we get on Google searches impact what we think is true and not true. It impacts what we think the world actually is. There's a lot of research that shows that our experiences on Facebook have come to substitute for other ways of socializing and thinking of community. Hmm. These are the platform, the most powerful platforms, I would say, in the history of communication technologies in our world. So it's not just about Vegas and a particular story. This is far more fundamental. These are incredibly powerful companies. Google is the biggest lobbyist in Washington, D.C. There's been material that's come out that's been alleged saying that a scholar was recently fired from the New America Foundation, potentially because of Google pressure. So this is far more important and fundamental than the mere sort of misinformation that came out in relation to this Las Vegas incident. Facebook has become the most powerful place for not just Americans, but many people around the world to experience some sort of sense of community. It's seen as supplanting many other ways of experiencing community. Google is the most influential platform in the history of the world in terms of finding information, and there's ample amount of research that shows that it impacts our cognition, it impacts the ways we think, it impacts political elections and people's decisions around that as well, and that impacting occurs based on how results are ordered, basically starting and ending more or less in the first few results on a search query. So these companies might be seen as sort of mere quote-unquote neutral technology platforms, but they have infused themselves very deeply into our minds, into our political lives, into our social lives, and as I argue in my book, our cultural lives. So for them to have such huge transgressions into every area of our life, and they're trying to gather more and more data by implanting their sorts of technologies into our homes in various ways, for them to have such incredible influence and to be so uncommunicative about how they choose to structure the world and what they choose to gather from us, that reflects an absence of social responsibility and is very much at odds with their language, where they frame themselves as sort of tools for the public, tools for the world, platforms of connectivity. If anything, we're finding out in this story and many other examples that actually they're using the language of connectivity, but we're actually increasingly isolated and misinformed thanks to companies that are operating computationally in ways that we really don't understand
right.
as users.
It seems as though we are more divided now as a result of these things than less divided. Well, finally, Ramesh, I wonder if Facebook and Google and these other companies, Twitter, et cetera, were to take up either some kind of content, people who are real human beings looking at content, if they were to improve their algorithms so that some of these fringe views were not elevated, I wonder if outlets like Gateway Pundit or Breitbart would just have such a huge outcry that they would be the ones pushing back saying, that they're suppressing free speech, right? I just can imagine that any sort of filter is going to face a huge backlash from the right.
Yeah, I mean, a huge part of how the Breitbart was able to grow was through its ability to proliferate its content on Facebook. It was the most politically trafficked news source in the 3 months before our election last year. So they need Facebook. They need Google, despite whatever they might say about free speech. My point here is that really, it's not really a problem with an algorithm in some sort of endemic sense. An algorithm is just a neutral way of trying, not neutral, but it's a way of trying to process information and structure information. It's the absence of a conversation, right? The companies need to tell us what they want to do with us. Like, why are we seeing what we're seeing? What are they gathering from us? What other possibilities might there be? And more generally, they need to accept their incredible power, which they want because it makes them so powerful and lucrative economically and now politically. But they need to accept that publicly and act like a politically accountable organization rather than hiding behind the language that we all use as geeks, which is like, oh, it's mere technological innovation. It's just better computers. It's Moore's Law. It's faster machines. Oh, it's just big data. Big data is a great thing. It's called big data. It's just artificial intelligence. It's not us. We humans in our organizations, cultures, and societies create these tools. And we can't let these tools be anything more than mere tools. We can't let them supplant our entire experiences of being and knowing and communicating.
Ramesh, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for all that you do.
It's my pleasure.
Ramesh Srinivasan is director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at the University of California, Los Angeles, author of Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.